Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're taking a look at something you see almost every day, but maybe don't think too much about. Flowering plants. Angiosperms.
Yeah, they're basically the dominant plants on Earth.
Yeah.
And we're digging into a really insightful lecture by Dr. Hoffman that covers everything from, you know, basic flower parts right up to gene editing.
So a guided tour through angiosperm biology, using Dr. Hoffman's work as our map.
Exactly. Skipping the dense textbook parts and getting straight to the, well, the really cool stuff.
And right off the bat, Dr. Hoffman flips the script on what a flower is. It's not mainly for reproduction itself.
Not directly, no. Think of it more like a giant flashy advertisement. Plants can't move, so they need help getting pollen around.
Right, they need pollinators, bees, birds, bats, whatever works.
Precisely. So the flower is the billboard. It offers a reward, usually nectar, like a little sugary drink. The animal comes with a treat, gets dusted with pollen, flies off, and delivers it. Simple transaction.
Usually simple. But Dr. Hoffman mentioned a case that sounds almost like cheating.
Oh, it's absolutely evolutionary trickery. Some orchids, for example, they don't waste energy making nectar.
So how do they get pollinated?
They produce a scent, a chemical mix, that smells exactly like a female bee of a certain species.
No way.
Yes. So the male bee comes along, thinks it's found a mate, tries to, mate with the flower.
Which obviously doesn't work.
Doesn't work for the bee.
Yeah.
But in the process, it gets covered in pollen. Then it flies off. Maybe it gets fooled again by another orchid. And boom, pollination happens. All reward, no cost to the plant. Pretty sneaky.
That's incredible. Okay, so let's get back to the basics. The structure of a normal flower. Dr. Hoffman talked about four main parts, the whorls.
That's right. Four layers, basically. You can group them. First, you have the sterile whorls, the sepals, often green little leaves at the base, and the petals, which are usually the colorful advertising part.
Sterile meaning they don't make the actual sex cells, the gametes?
Correct. They're for protection or attraction.
Hmm.
Then you get the fertile whorls where the action happens.
Okay, so that's the male and female parts.
Yep. The stamens are the male parts. Each one is typically a stalk called the filament with an anther on top. The anther is where the pollen grains carrying the male gametes are made.
Got it. And the female parts?
Those are the carpels. Often in the center, maybe fused together, looking kind of like a bowling pin.
A bowling pin. Okay, I can picture that.
So the swollen base is the ovary, and inside that are the ovules, the potential seeds containing the eggs. Then there's a stalk, the style, leading up to the stigma.
Which needs to be sticky, right, to catch the pollen.
Exactly. Often has a resin or something sticky on it. That's the landing pad for the pollen grain.
Okay, basic structure down. But then Dr. Hoffman introduced something that sounded revolutionary. The ABC hypothesis. It explains how these four different whorls actually develop.
Yes, and it's beautifully simple, genetically speaking. It boils down to just three master control genes, A, B, and C.
Three genes control all that structure. How?
Think of the flower developing in concentric circles from the outside in. Gene A, working alone, directs the development of sepals, the outermost whorl. Where gene A and gene B overlap, in the next circle inwards, you get petals.
Ah, so the combination matters.
Right. Then, where gene B and gene C overlap, you get the stamens, the male parts.
Okay, A plus B is petals, B plus C is stamens.
And in the very center, gene C, working alone, directs the formation of the carpels, the female parts.
Wow. Sepals, A, petals, A plus B, stamens, B plus C, carpels, C. That's elegant.
It really is. And Dr. Hoffman showed how this works using mutants. Like if you knock out the C gene.
Then you wouldn't get stamens or carpels because both need C.
Exactly. You'd get a flower with only sepals and petals. Maybe petals where the stamens should be and sepals where the carpels should be. Completely sterile. It proves these three genes are the master switches.
Mind-blowing. Okay, so that connects the structure to the genes. Now, Dr. Hoffman mentioned the three Fs unique to angiosperms. Flowers, fruit, and double fertilization. Let's tackle that last one.
All right. Double fertilization. This is really the defining feature, reproductively. But first, a super quick detour into the plant life cycle. It's called alternation of generations.
Okay, I vaguely remember this. The big plant we see is the sporophyte.
Which is diploid, 2N, like us. But it produces spores that grow into a tiny separate structure called the gametophyte, which is haploid N.
And the gametophytes make the actual gametes, sperm, and eggs.
Correct. In angiosperms, the male gametophyte is ridiculously small. It's essentially the pollen grain, just two or three cells. The female gametophyte is a bit bigger, but still tiny, hidden inside the ovule.
How big is bit bigger?
It's typically a structure with just 7 cells and 8 nuclei. Really stripped down, it contains the egg cell, obviously, but also this unique cell called the central cell, which has 2 haploid nuclei and some helper cells, centrogids, that release chemicals to guide the pollen tube.
Okay, so pollen lands, grows a tube down to the ovule, carrying 2 sperm cells, right?
Yes, that's key. 2 male gametes travel down the pollen tube.
And this is where the double part happens. What do they do?
Okay, the pollen tube reaches the ovule and releases the 2 sperm. Sperm number 1 does the expected thing. It fertilizes the egg cell.
Egg N plus sperm N makes a zygote, 2N, the baby plant embryo.
Exactly. Standard fertilization. But sperm number 2 does something completely different. It fuses with that weird central cell.
The one that already had 2 nuclei, so N plus N plus N?
Precisely. It forms a triploid, 3N cell. This cell divides and develops into the endosperm.
Triploid. That sounds weird. What's the endosperm?
It's the food supply. It's the nutrient-rich tissue inside the seed that will feed the embryo as it starts to grow before it can photosynthesize. Think about corn kernels or the white part of coconut. That's endosperm.
So one fertilization makes the embryo, the other makes the food supply. Why? Why this complicated double system?
Ah, now that's the fascinating part. According to Dr. Hoffman's hypothesis, it's all about saving energy.
How so?
Making fruit and seeds is really expensive for the plant. Lots of sugars, nutrients, water. It's a huge investment. The plant doesn't want to make that investment unless it's sure fertilization was successful and the embryo is actually viable. So the second fertilization, the one creating the 3N endosperm, acts like a confirmation signal. If both fertilizations happen, then the endosperm starts developing.
Ah, the development of the food supply itself is the trigger.
Kind of. It signals that everything worked. Only then does the plant really commit the resources to developing the whole seed and the surrounding fruit. If the second fertilization fails, no endosperm develops, and the plant basically cuts its losses and aborts that ovule, maybe even the whole flower.
So double fertilization is like a quality control check or an insurance mechanism before the plant builds the expensive house, the fruit.
That's a great way to put it, an energy-saving insurance policy.
Okay, that makes sense. So after successful double fertilization, the ovule becomes the seed. Inside, you've got the embryo, 2N, and its lunchbox, the endosperm, 3N.
Right, and Dr. Hoffman pointed out that development starts immediately. Even when the embryo is just 2 cells, it's already differentiating. One cell is destined to become the main embryo. The other forms a sort of anchor or stalk.
And those first leaves inside the seed, the cotyledons.
Yeah, seed leaves. Their main job isn't photosynthesis initially. It's to transfer the stored food from the endosperm to the growing embryo, especially while it's still underground in the dark.
Right. Then the seed needs a signal to germinate. Water, maybe light, maybe even fire.
Yeah, some species, especially in fire-prone areas, need smoke or heat. It signals that competitors have been cleared out, making it a good time to sprout.
And how they sprout differs, too. Dr. Hoffman contrasted beans and corn.
Right. A eudicot, like a garden bean, has a taproot. When it germinates, the embryonic stem forms a hook to protect the delicate tip as it pushes through the soil, dragging the cotyledons up. A monocot, like corn, has fibrous roots. It uses a tough protective sheath called the coleoptile to literally spear its way through the soil, shielding the young shoot. Different strategies.
Very cool. Okay, let's talk about the final product, the fruit. Botanically, it's just what the flower develops into after success.
Yep, whether we eat it or not. A pea pod is a fruit. A sunflower seed in its shell is a fruit.
But the classifications can get weird. Simple fruit from one ovary, aggregate from one flower with many carpels, multiple from many flowers fusing. But the one that really messes with people's heads is the accessory fruit.
Ah, yes, the apple. The classic example.
So what's the deal with an apple? The part we eat isn't the real fruit.
Not botanically speaking, no. The fleshy part you eat actually develops from the receptacle, the part of the flower stalk where the other parts were attached below the ovary.
So where is the actual fruit?
The true fruit devolved from the ovary is the core. The part you usually throw away, the papery structure around the seeds, that's the botanical fruit. The apple is mostly accessory tissue.
That definitely goes against the kitchen definition.
Totally. It highlights how botanical terms focus purely on developmental origin.
Now, plants also have ways to control who they reproduce with, right? Dr. Hoffman talked about avoiding inbreeding.
Absolutely. Just like in animals, inbreeding can bring harmful recessive genes together. So plants have evolved all sorts of mechanisms to promote outcrossing mating with unrelated individuals.
Like what?
Well, the simplest is being dioecious. That just means having separate male and female plants, like holly trees or willows. can't self-pollinate if you only have one type of flower.
Would make sense. Any other tricks?
Oh, yeah. There's a cool structural thing called heterostyle, like the thrum and pin flowers Dr. Hoffman mentioned.
Thrum and pin.
Yeah. Some species have two flower forms. In pin flowers, the stigma, female part, is high up, and the anthers, male parts, are low down. In thrum flowers, it's the opposite, anthers high, stigma low.
Okay, so different arrangements. Why?
Think about a bee visiting. If it visits a pin flower, it gets pollen on a lower part of its body. If it then visits another pin flower, that pollen won't likely hit the high up stigma.
Mm.
But if it flies to a thrum flower, the low pollen lines up perfectly with the low stigma.
Huh. And pollen from the high anthers of a thrum flower would only effectively pollinate the high stigma of a pin flower.
Exactly. It forces the pollinator to act as a go-between for the two different morphs, ensuring cross-pollination. It's ingenious structural biology.
Nature is clever. But then humans get involved. Dr. Hoffman talked about how we've been manipulating plant genetics for ages.
Since the dawn of agriculture. Artificial selection. We picked the plants with traits we liked, saved their seeds, and repeated. Dr. Hoffman pointed out modern corn is so dependent on us, it literally couldn't survive in the wild anymore. It's a human creation built over millennia.
And now we can do it much, much faster with biotechnology. But first, cloning. Why are plants relatively easy to clone compared to animals?
It comes down to something called tutipotency and special tissues called meristems. Plants keep pools of permanently young cells in their growing tips, the meristems.
Like stem cells.
Very much like stem cells, but maybe even more versatile in some ways. These cells are tutipotent, meaning a single cell retains the potential to divide and differentiate into any other type of cell and eventually a whole new plant.
So you can just take a small piece?
Right. Take a piece of leaf or stem, put it in a lab culture, provide the right hormones, and it can de-differentiate into a disorganized mass called a callus. Then tweak the hormones, and that callus will start growing roots and shoots, forming a clone of the original plant. Animals generally lose that total flexibility in most of their cells much earlier.
That ability really opens the door for modern genetic modification, doesn't it?
It certainly makes it easier. Dr. Hoffman contrasted the old way, selective breeding, with the new way, direct gene editing, or GMOs.
And he made a distinction within GMOs. Transgenesis versus cisgenesis.
Yeah, it's an important distinction often lost in the public debate. Transgenesis is when you take a gene from a completely unrelated organism, the classic example being putting a jellyfish gene for fluorescence into a mouse.
Okay, crossing major species boundaries.
Right. Cisgenesis, on the other hand, is moving a gene from a closely related species, one that could potentially hybridize naturally, or even from a different variety of the same species. It's much more like an accelerated version of traditional breeding in some ways.
And Dr. Hoffman used the example of cassava to show the potential benefits, right?
Yes, a really powerful example. Cassava is a staple food crop for hundreds of millions of people, especially in Africa. But it has limitations. It's not very nutritionally complete, lacking certain vitamins, and it naturally contains cyanide precursors, toxins that need to be carefully processed out.
Which can be a problem, especially for poor communities.
A huge problem. So scientists used biotechnology, likely a mix of techniques, to create improved cassava varieties. They engineered them to produce beta carotene, which our bodies convert to vitamin A, addressing a major deficiency.
So making it more nutritious. Golden rice is another example of that idea.
Exactly. And they also work to reduce the levels of those cyanide precursors, making it safer and easier to prepare. This isn't just about crop yields. It's about direct improvements to human health and nutrition on a massive scale.
That really puts the technology in perspective. So wrapping this all up, looking back at Dr. Hoffman's lecture through this deep dive, the complexity is just stunning.
It really is. From the elegant simplicity of the ABC genes controlling the whole flower structure, to the sheer ingenuity of double fertilization as an energy-saving check. Angiosperms are masters of efficiency and adaptation.
We see these plants everywhere, but the biological sophistication hidden inside that Dr. Hoffman laid out is just incredible.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And maybe the most profound thought for me comes back to that scale difference. You have this huge, visible plant, the sporophyte we interact with. But the critical moment, the decision point for making the next generation, happens invisibly inside an ovule, involving a tiny 7-celled female gametophyte and 2 microscopic sperm cells.
It makes you wonder, doesn't it, how much of the really crucial action driving life on this planet happens at a scale we completely overlook every single day.
Exactly. What other microscopic dramas are deciding the macroscopic world around us? Something to think about.